Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. If you're looking for a new book to read, we can help. Best-selling author Dan Brown is with us to talk about his new novel, Origin. He brings some familiar themes and a familiar character into the plot, the Catholic Church and Robert Langdon. Langdon and the Church first appeared more than a decade ago in Brown's blockbuster bestsellers, The Da Vinci Code, Angels and Demons, and in others since. The official release date of the book is tomorrow, and he'll be in St. Louis Wednesday to discuss Origin at the County Library headquarters on Lindbergh. Dan Brown joins us now by phone. A great pleasure to talk to you, Dan Brown.
Good morning. Nice to talk to you.
You know, I just got your book on Friday, and I've only gotten halfway through it. I'm enjoying it, and I have to give you a lot of credit for your ability to hook the reader on page one. I didn't think I would get as much of that book finished as I did, but once I got going, I couldn't stop.
That's a good sign, and that's what I'm trying to do when I set out to write these.
You know, I have to ask you, you've had obviously a great deal of success, and with that has come financial independence. Does that make writing easier or harder for you?
You know, I don't really feel like it changes the writing process. You still face a blank page every day. Your characters don't really care how many books you've sold. And I write these books really to educate myself. I love to learn, and to set out to write a book like Origin, you know, where I've got to learn about modern art and artificial intelligence and all sorts of topics I don't know a lot about, is an educational adventure, and it's a lot of fun for me.
Well, what are you thinking about what you've learned about artificial intelligence?
Well, it's clearly alarming. And yet it's also incredibly exciting. I've spent a lot of time talking to scientists in the fields of artificial intelligence, and they really disagree as to whether artificial intelligence is going to be a boon for humanity, whether it's going to solve some of the big problems we face on Earth, problems like scarcity, pollution, overpopulation. Artificial intelligence could have a very positive role in solving some of our big questions. At the same time, it also could have kind of an ominous role, in that it's incredibly powerful and will only get more powerful. And historically, humans have never created a technology that they have not weaponized. So, you know, you look at nuclear power, you know, great, but we've learned how to use it to kill each other. And the question is, will this technology, like those before it, also be used for evil, or for harm?
You know, I heard I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, that's just sort of one of the questions that these scientists have about artificial intelligence, and one of the reasons it's so relevant to all of us. I tend to be more of an optimist, but these are going to be strange days, and they all agree that the future is coming much faster than we think.
You know, I heard an interview on NPR the other day in which this subject was discussed, and one of the people that they were talking to said, you know, the humans have no problem stepping on an ant colony and killing a lot of ants. And he said the day could very well come in which artificial intelligence could do the same to us.
Certainly, without a doubt. And, you know, Elon Musk has sort of stood up and said, we need to have kill switches on artificial intelligence. And he's not getting any pushback, you know, from scientists. I mean, that makes perfect sense, of course. The problem is, what happens when artificial intelligence teaches itself to be smarter than we are and decides it doesn't want a kill switch? What happens at that moment? And that's really, really where the debate lies.
We obviously, in talking about your book, want to talk about some of the elements of it without doing a spoiler thing for our listeners. But while we're on the subject of artificial intelligence, I do want to mention one character in the book, the character Winston, which is essentially a computer. It is a computer. I was told by your publicists that all the technology in your book is real, stuff that we have today. But Winston seems to go above and beyond where I seem to think we are today.
Well, you know, the amazing thing about technology is it is exponential. Every tool that we create becomes a tool to create more technology. And so you get this exponential curve. And certainly, you know, the Turing test was passed long ago. You know, we all carry miniature Winstons in our pockets with Siri or whatever our little devices are. And so if you can imagine what happens when you have enormous computing power, you know, these are things that are happening right now. And it's really very exciting.
How much time did you spend talking with scientists about all of this? And what are some of the things that you learned that you didn't know going into those discussions?
I knew a little bit about artificial intelligence, but the things that I spent about a year reading everything I could about artificial intelligence and talking to scientists at the Barcelona Supercomputing Center, which was fascinating to me. And the aspect of AI that I really find most interesting is this idea of a synthetic consciousness. And this idea that what happens if we create a machine that becomes self-aware? And the hypothetical question, we create a machine that becomes self-aware, and what if we leave it in the dark, all alone, we tell it nothing about who created it or why? It's sort of floating in a digital void, kind of like humans are floating in the void of space. Will this computer start to come up with stories about where it came from, who its master, who its creator is? And if it does, can we learn philosophical answers? For example, if a computer wants to know where it came from, can we extrapolate and simply say that one of the byproducts of consciousness is needing to have a creator? And could that be the source of religious thought in all of human history?
Well, that kind of brings us to the book. Again, I don't want to get too deep into the weeds with regard to it, and maybe you can help out in that regard. I mean, I think that the question that is asked over and over again in the book, at least the half of it that I've read so far, and I'm sure it will continue, is the question, where do we come from and where are we going? Why don't you kind of broad stroke that for us to give folks an idea of what the story is about? We already know that artificial intelligence plays a role in the story, a very prominent role, but that question is really what drives this story.
Sure. In ancient times, when humans didn't understand, when they had a question they couldn't answer, for example, why do the tides move or why does the sun come up, they created gods that were the answers. At some point, science said, the tides don't move because of Poseidon. They move because of gravity and the moon. And that god disappeared. And we no longer look to science for the answers to why plague spread or why the tides move. Science has answered that. We look to religion for a couple of big questions that science can't answer. What are we doing here? Where did we come from? What's our purpose? What happens when we die? Where are we going? And these are still the realm of religion. But historically, if you look at what has happened to the gods of the past, meaning they've all fallen eventually, the questions slowly become answered. You have to ask yourself if we're naive to believe that the gods of today will be here in 100 years or 1,000 years. And this book really asks a fundamental question, and that is, will God survive science? Historically, God does not survive science. And the question is, will our gods of today actually survive technologies like artificial intelligence?
Well, you say in the book, there's science versus religion, and both sides asking the same questions. I think you put it this way, both sides asking the same questions, but with a different vocabulary.
Sure. Science and religion are two different languages trying to tell the same story, trying to answer the same questions. And they deal with them in very, very different ways. Religion tends to savor the questions. Science really demands answers. And that's where the two of them kind of clash a bit.
Where do you stand in all of this?
I grew up the son of a mathematics teacher, math textbook writer, actually, and a very devout Christian church organist. My mom was a devout Christian church organist. I sang in the choir. I grew up in a very religious household. But I also was encouraged to ask questions. So when I wrote the Da Vinci Code, and asking the hypothetical question of, what would it mean for Christianity if Jesus were not literally the Son of God, I didn't imagine that was going to be controversial. It seemed like a perfectly reasonable question to ask. And so clearly naive of me, but I was surprised when that book was so controversial. As far as where I fall now, I no longer believe in the gods of my childhood, in a vengeful god created Adam and Eve fully formed in the Garden of Eden, and yet I'm not sure I'm ready to take the leap into atheism. I think I'm sort of a work in progress, probably on the on the side of leaning toward atheism, but really agnostic at the moment.
You seem drawn to the dark side of the church, if you will, but particularly the Catholic Church. Were you raised Catholic?
I was raised Episcopalian, which anybody who knows both of them will say, well, that's close enough.
Pretty close, yeah. pretty close.
You know, I don't know if I'm drawn to the dark side of religion. I believe religion does an enormous amount of good in the world, but I also believe that it does some bad. And the challenge with religion, I believe, or at least with my faith, the faith of my childhood, is that when we start taking our metaphors, these beautiful biblical fables like Adam and Eve, and start declaring that they are literal fact, that's when we run into problems. If you read Adam and Eve as a morality tale, wonderful. It has plenty to teach us. When you are a U.S. congressman who stands up and says Adam and Eve is literal fact, the earth is 6,000 years old, and the fossil record was put there by God to test our faith, that's when I start to have problems with religion. And the real issue with religion is that we have entered this age of political correctness when we're not allowed to question. If you tell me the earth is flat, I'm allowed to come to you and say, actually, I think that's crazy because here's a picture and it's a sphere. If you come to me, because that's not a religious idea, if you come to me with the idea that all of the races on the planet and all of their different manifestations around the globe came from two individuals who, you know, materialized in the Garden of Eden, I'm not allowed to say, well, that, you know, there's some scientific problems with that. It's protected as a religious idea. And not only are we not allowed to question it, we are actually debating in the year 2017 whether or not to teach it in our schools. And that's when I start to feel that religion can do harm.
I'd like to pick up on a couple of those points and will, but I have to take a break. Our guest on St. Louis on the Air today is Dan Brown. He's the author of Origin. It's his brand new book. He sold 200 million books, by the way, over the course of the years, which is not too shabby if you're a writer. We'll come back, continue our conversation about Origin and other things in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. And welcome back. We'll continue our conversation with novelist Dan Brown. Dan, I want to pick up on something you were just talking about political correctness and religion just before that break. I wouldn't want to get into a political conversation with you, but what is your take on the influence of religion in our politics today?
Well, you know, we allegedly have a separation of church and state. I think it's absolutely fine if people look to their religion as a moral guidepost and essentially say, look, you know, I derive my personal moral underpinnings from my faith, and I'm going to run for office, and I'm going to use that faith to make decisions. I've got no problem with that. The problem, I think, comes from not being able to question ideologies because they fall under the banner of religion. Religion should not be waived as some kind of immunity from rational scrutiny. We should be able to question respectfully and challenge all ideas.
What sort of reaction? I know you haven't toured for a book in a couple of years, 4 years, I think I read. What sort of reaction over the years have you gotten from people as you tour with regard to your novels and religion, and in particular the Catholic Church?
You know, it's fascinating. When the Da Vinci Code came out, I got a lot of mail from nuns who, you know, and every time I got mail that was from a religious institution, I sort of thought, uh-oh. But the mail from nuns was universally positive, and they said, hey, you know, thank you for writing a book that celebrates the sacred feminine. Thank you for pointing out that we live, that we as nuns give our lives over to the church and yet are still unfit to give communion or stand behind the altar. So I got a lot of positive response. Of course, there was plenty of backlash as well, you know, from the Vatican. Cardinal Bertone was very upset with the Da Vinci Code, felt it was blasphemous. I felt that it was asking a hypothetical question. And, you know, this new book is asking hypothetical questions as well. And, you know, my guess is it too will be controversial, but I really think of it as sparking dialogue. I don't think of controversy as a bad thing. I think it makes people have to quantify what they believe and be able to articulate it.
Do you get you've sold an enormous number of books overseas. Do you get the same kind of reaction when you tour overseas that you get here at home?
You know, it's funny. The reaction overseas is much more universally positive, strangely. You know, the U.S. is really, we're in this strange time where there's this pretty big chasm between science and religion. And we have a lot of very strict traditionalists in this country who are quite vocal. And, you know, that's terrific. It creates dialogue, and it's important. But overseas, I think maybe because Europe has sort of been through their puritanical phase and have come out the other side, it's a little bit more universally enthusiastic.
We talked just before going on the air, and you said you're touring here. 8 cities in the U.S., a number of cities in Europe, and what was it, 14 in Latin America?
Yeah, I think it's 14 in Europe, and then I go to Latin America, and I'm not sure what that is, but I've actually never been to South America, which is surprising, considering I lived in Spain for a while as a child. I went to University of Seville in Spain. I speak Spanish, and I have an enormous readership in South America, and decided that this book in particular, because it is deals so directly with religion and emerging technologies, that it just felt very relevant to South America, and I was excited to go down and hear what they thought of it.
Well, I'm sure you're getting near full. That's pretty much Catholic country down there.
We'll see if I make it home.
You know, you'll make it home. I wanted to talk to you about your research on this book. I didn't realize, and I should have, I suppose, that you had spent so much time in Spain as a student. But obviously you did spend a lot of time there. But the book is set in Spain, for those who don't know that yet. I started to ask about your research there. Did you go back specifically to research for this book, or did you have everything you needed from your time there earlier?
Oh, no. I went back numerous times to research origin. I spent a lot of time in Bilbao at the Guggenheim Museum there learning about modern art, spent time at the Barcelona Supercomputing Center, spent a lot of time studying Antoni Gaudi, Sagrada Familia, Casa Mila. It's such a pleasurable process. It's difficult, but really, really rewarding, the amount I get to learn to try to write these books.
I don't know if you know who Ridley Pearson is. He is a fellow author from St. Louis, and he's had some success himself. He wrote a book recently which was set in Istanbul, and he was very, very descriptive of the place. And come to find out that he never went there, that he did all of that research about the city itself and locations on Google, in Google Maps, which seems to be a new way a lot of authors are doing their research.
You know what? And it's a boon for readers as well, because it's easier for authors to set books in exotic locations. And it's kind of funny, when I wrote The Da Vinci Code, the internet wasn't really up and running quite yet. I mean, you couldn't sort of pull up the World Wide Web and look at a bunch of pictures. Certainly Google Maps wasn't around. And the thing that's kind of fun now is if, as a writer, you set a scene in a restaurant, you know, Mr. Pearson might set a scene in a restaurant in Istanbul, he can just go to that restaurant's website, pull up their menu, and have his characters eat exactly what is there. He can email the chef and say, how do you prepare the following dish such that I can, you know. And so the readers get really very accurate, specific information, which is fun.
Have you done that?
I have indeed. I try to get to all these locations in person, but certainly there are times when you're trying to decide whether or not to set a scene in a certain part of the city or a certain country, and you do the initial research online, and you say, you know what, this could really work. And then in my case, I go there almost without exception. I will go there in person just because I feel that it's very difficult to create the ambiance of a location without having been there, and also because I like to travel.
What is your basic process like? Are you up before dawn writing, or do you do it more casually than that, less stringent schedule?
There's nothing casual about it, unfortunately. I am at my desk at 4 a.m. 7 days a week. I'm an early riser, and that's what I do. I go to a location that has no internet and no phone, and I work from 4 a.m. until, I'll write until 10, 11, 12 sometimes if it's going well. And then I sort of re-enter the world and deal with the business of life. But the mornings really are the time that I focus very intently. I'm somebody who edits myself pretty ferociously for every page you read in the book. I've written 10 that got thrown away. And it is definitely a ritual. It's not casual.
What sort of output do you have on a day-to-day basis, would you say?
Well, you know, it depends. It could be a day when I'm spending a lot of time reading. But if it's a day that I'm writing, I write slowly. There's a whole lot of people who write faster than I do. If I write a couple of pages, that's a very good day.
Let's take a call, Dan Brown. We have Mike calling us from St. Louis. He has a question about AI, I believe. So let's take his call. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi, Don and Dan. Good news. The future is secure. I've been considering the concept of artificial intelligence since 1967, and I argued then as long as we have diverse input, the outcome will be good. And I still think that's the case because we've seen, years where the internet was going to take us down or viruses were going to take us down, and we figured out a way to, countermand it through diverse processes. So I'm very positive on the future.
I agree with you wholeheartedly, and I think you will like the ending of Origin if you read it.
I'm going to get a positive
outcome.
Thanks.
Mike, thanks for the call. This is a big book. This is almost 500 pages long. That's why I'm only halfway through, Dan.
It's a big topic, and, it's important to remember, these are thrillers. They're supposed to be fun to read. You learn a lot along the way, but it's a chase. It's a puzzle. There are codes. There are symbols. I always loved teachers who made learning fun. And that's why I created A Hero Who's a Teacher. My dad's a teacher, a very good teacher. And so these books should be fun, but also informative.
Is Langdon based on anyone you know?
He's kind of a composite of a lot of my favorite teachers. He's really the man I wish I could be. He's a lot braver than I am.
But, I kind of thought maybe a little bit of you was in Langdon as well. There's one line, for instance, where he is in a Tesla and is asked to drive, and he says, "I'm not a car man." And I saw an interview with you in which you said, "I'm not a car man." So,
well, you know what? You have a very good eye. And it's true. I'm not a car guy. It's funny. After 3 years after the Da Vinci Code had come out, I still had the same kind of rusted Volvo that I'd always had. And my friends said, like, "Why don't you have a Maserati?" And the truth was, it just hadn't really occurred to me. I'm not that interested in cars. I do, however, now have Edmund Kearse's car. Edmund Kearse is the protagonist. He is the futurist who drives that black electric Tesla SUV that has self-driving capability. And I now trust my car to drive me, down to Boston, which is an hour away, and I don't touch the wheel. So it's pretty impressive technology.
Well, aside from the making the Tesla character in the car, how do you come up with a plot like this? Is it something you've fully worked out and outlined before you started? Is it a lot of it come to you as you're working on it?
These books, because there's so many twists and turns, need to be heavily outlined. Otherwise, you just paint yourself into the corner and realize there's no ending. All of these books, this one included, are heavily outlined. At the same time, as you're working through it, you realize certain scenes don't work and they fall away and you have ideas for a different approach. But the general arc of the story is planned well in advance.
You've had a number of your books made into films. When writing, are you ever thinking along those lines that I'm writing scenes that would play very well on film?
I don't. I think it's because I spend so much time writing and so little time on movie sets And you know what? I mean, working with Ron Howard and Tom Hanks has been an incredible treat. It's been a lot of fun. It's been very educational for me. I didn't understand how difficult it is to make a movie until I'd watched people do it. These books are hard to adapt. And the one thing that they've done well is that they've really been respectful of the heartbeat of each story. They've taken that big moral or ethical dilemma and really preserved it in each of these stories.
Well, I've heard authors say, however, that once they've signed the deal, it's like giving away the baby, that they no longer have any kind of control at all over the story.
Yeah, you know, that I think is accurate. I have something called a meaningful consultation, which I think is pretty unmeaningful. I don't know what that means. But the reality is, Tom Hanks and Ron Howard have a few more Oscars than I do. I'm not going to tell these guys how to make a movie. I would never presume to do that. And what I've really come to understand is that movies are, it's almost like it's just a different telling of your idea. You cannot expect them to be absolutely, faithful to the book, because they would be 12 hours long. These are movie makers who read the book and say, this is the spine of it. This is the underpinning, and this is how we're going to make the movie. And you're just grateful that anybody even feels like making a movie.
I'm going to try to get another couple of callers in if we can. I'm not sure I'll be able to, but let's see what we can. Corinne calling from Rock Hill. Let's see if she's there.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
Okay, hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am fascinated by the amount of research that you put into your books, and I'm wondering, just as a writer myself, what the process is like between research and writing. Do you spend a year researching and then write, or write and research, or
how does that work? It's a great question. For these books, I tend to research exclusively for about a year. And then while I'm writing over the course of 2 or 3 years, I will go back and research. But I'll warn you that research is fun, and at some point becomes procrastination. At some point you need to say, I know what I need to know, and it's time to write the book, knowing that you can always go back and fill it in later. So that would be my advice to you. Enjoy the research, but just make sure you know when to stop and when it's time to actually write the book.
Corinne, thank you for the call. Let's try Terry in Belleville. Terry, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Dan and Don. Very happy to talk to both of you. I was in Edinburgh last year and went to the Roslyn Chapel, and the people there give you tons of credit for bringing in thousands and thousands of tourists, and they've redone a lot of the areas. And I want to know if you ever went to Roslyn Chapel, because they weren't sure you'd ever visited.
Oh, my heavens, yes. I most certainly was there a number of times. I was there twice researching the Da Vinci Code. I was there numerous times making the movie. And I've actually been back kind of incognito a little bit to see the whole visitor center and all of that. Roslyn is a spectacular chapel, and I'm just grateful that so many people are seeing it now.
Well, it was a real joy to go visit, especially after I enjoyed the Da Vinci Code so much. So thank you.
Thank you.
Terry, thank you for the call. Let's bring in Sharon. Sharon, you're on the air with Dan Brown. Sharon, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead, please.
I'm fascinated by your research also and look forward to reading your book. And, Don, I love your program.
Thank you.
I do want to respectfully contradict something you said earlier in the program, though, regarding the ant colonies.
Mm-hmm.
You said that no human being would have any trouble stepping on an ant colony. I think this is reflective of a mentality. Not all human beings are of that mindset, including myself, and I think it's part of the whole world concept and creation that we would feel that way about other species, and I just wanted to say not all human beings feel that way.
Sharon, I understand that, and I was actually quoting something that I heard on NPR, but surely you're correct on that.
Okay. Thank you so much.
What do you think, Dan?
I think we better watch our step when there's ant colonies around.
That's right.
She makes a good point.
She absolutely does. Okay, we have time for one more call. We'll bring in Lydia calling from Afton. Lydia, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
Dan Brown said something to the effect that he doesn't mind people using their religion to formulate their code of ethics in the political realm. I think it's the other way around. Evolution has given you a sense of ethics, and that was codified into your religion. What does he think?
I'm not sure I entirely understand the question, but I think I'm sure I don't understand your question.
Okay, well, there's animals that do things altruistically, you know, like the buck that jumps when the leopard comes, and they're going to get eaten, but the herd will go on.
Sure.
This is
a
moral sense.
Evolution has given each of us a sense of ethics and morality that is hardwired into our DNA. We do not need to be religious to know that killing people is wrong. And whether we draw our morality from what's intrinsically wired into us or from our religion or from our friends, it is definitely part of us. And I was just sort of saying that wherever a politician draws his ethics or her ethics from is his or her own business, as long as those ethics are there.
Let's let it go at that. Time is winding down with Dan Brown. I did have a note here. Someone wanted to know, and I know it's early. The book is just out tomorrow. Do you have any sense of a movie deal with this one at this point?
Well, Sony Pictures has the rights, and we'll see if they would like to make a movie. I'll leave that in their court, my call.
That is certainly a good first step, though. Dan Brown, we want to thank you so much for spending so much time with us, and you'll be in St. Louis later this week. I understand your appearance at the County Library headquarters is sold out, another good sign for you, I would think. But we look forward to having you in St. Louis.
I look forward to being there. Thank you so much.
Thank you. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.